from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. After months of protest by the U.S.-backed opposition in Venezuela, not only failed to isolate the socialist government of Nicolas Maduro, but led to the most lopsided defeat ever suffered by Washington inside its own creature, the Organization of American States, opposition leaders sat down with President Maduro and his staff at a meeting sponsored by UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations. We have this report from Press TV.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro sits down for the first time with opposition leader Enrique Capriles. The two are holding talks to end weeks of deadly unrest in the Latin American country. The televised meeting involves some 20 representatives from both sides. Foreign ministers of Brazil, Colombia, and Ecuador, as well as a Vatican representative, have also attended the talks. Maduro agreed to a face-to-face meeting with Capriles after the regional group of the Union of South American Nations offered to mediate. Venezuela has witnessed nationwide street unrest since early February this year.
We discussed this and other news from the region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, in Managua, and we'll bring you that discussion later in this newscast. A 48-hour deadline set by the coup government in Kiev came and went Friday, and protesters who were told to abandon the government buildings they have occupied or face violent expulsion remain in control of the heart of two cities in Ukraine, Donetsk and Lugansk. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe reports.
Pro-Russian protesters in major eastern Ukrainian cities have dismissed government concessions and are refusing to leave occupied stealth buildings for the fifth day in a row. The defiance comes as a 48-hour ultimatum by Kiev to lay down arms has expired. Protesters continue to raise barricades in front of the state security headquarters in the city of Luhansk. Protest leaders have announced that they are forming a united large group of volunteer army with other eastern and southern cities that demand a Crimea-like referendum. Demonstrators have issued a 10-hour ultimatum to local leaders to decide about the referendum. Meanwhile, pro-Russian activists in the nearby city of Donetsk say at least 1,500 volunteers have joined the army of their self-proclaimed state called the People's Republic of Donetsk. They're also forming their interim government before the region's referendum scheduled for May 11. A refusal by pro-Russia activists comes as the new Ukrainian government has promised to offer greater powers to the volatile regions near the border with Russia.
I would like to say clearly that the central government is not only ready for dialogue with regions, but is ready to fulfill lawful requirements and wishes of all of the citizens of our country. In the framework of the changed constitution, we will be able to satisfy a specific request of every single region.
Graham Phillips was on the scene in Lugansk and gave this report to RT.
The SBU building now in its sixth day of occupation by pro-Russia activists. The deadline given of 12 o'clock by the Kiev government for them to vacate that building wasn't acknowledged by them. And they tell us they do not acknowledge that government and will not accept any ultimatums given by them. What people here are saying is they want a referendum. Behind me we can see barricades, they're fortifying barricades, they're building fires to keep themselves warm here in Lugansk in these sub-zero conditions. There are reports of snipers arrived here and real fears of actions manifesting over the weekend. For now, we wait to see what's going to happen. They didn't let us in the building once more as that administrative centre does go into lockdown as the days ahead seem set to see more scenes of action here in Lugansk.
Meanwhile, RT's Marina Finoshina was in Donetsk.
Ukraine's interior minister gave a 48-hour deadline to anti-Kiev protesters inside this 11-story regional administration building in the center of Donetsk to free it and to end the siege. But as you can see, the deadline already expired on Friday, but protesters are still here. And we hear that more and more people join this movement. And just this night, a large group of mine workers from the region's numerous mines came here to show their solidarity with protesters and to support them. These people want a referendum to get more independence from Kiev to be held here in this region. People continue fortifying not only the entrance of this building but also surrounding area. They use sandbags, barbed wire, bricks, tires, pieces of old cars, and actually everything anything that could be used to further barricades, people protect themselves as well. We see more and more masked, camouflaged young men carrying makeshift clubs and shields, wearing construction helmets like this one. Mariv Noshna, RT from Donetsk in Ukraine.
Meanwhile, RT is reporting that Ukrainian security forces refused to attack the protesters, saying that attacking civilians would violate Ukrainian law. And a pro-federalization rally was underway Friday at Svoboda Ploshad, or Freedom Square, in the eastern Ukrainian city of Kharkov. Demonstrators set up a tent near the square's Lenin statue and were handing out leaflets in support of federalization. Protesters wore red, blue, and white ribbons, symbolizing Russia's national flag. Meanwhile, Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, met U.S. and EU allegations of Russian involvement in the unrest with a strong denial that Moscow was involved, and he said Russia had not deployed any soldiers or security agents to Ukraine's eastern or southern regions. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has claimed that Moscow is sending spies to eastern Ukraine to, quote, create chaos, closed quote. And Russian President Vladimir Putin said Friday that Washington's offer to provide $1 billion in loan guarantees to Ukraine is worthless, since no banks are willing to lend to finance the recovery of the crisis-laden country. He called Washington's negative response to a letter he had addressed to European leaders containing specific proposals to solve the Ukrainian crisis a bit strange, since the U.S. has thus far only offered guarantees rather than actual loans.
It's strange that the Department of State comments on the letter I wrote to the heads of European nations. That's somewhat strange because, first of all, it's wrong to read other people's letters. I did not write to them. I wrote to the consumers of our gas in Europe. We got used to the fact that our US friends listen to other people's conversations, but reading other people's letters is too much. On a serious note, though, I obviously have to remind everybody that the pricing formula is included in the official contract that Russia's Gazprom signed with Ukraine's Naftogaz in 2009. And the people who are in charge of energy in the current government are the same people who were in the government back then. And they were involved in signing that contract. The pricing formula has not changed since that time. On April the 7th, Ukraine was supposed to make a monthly payment for the gas it received in March. It was over $500 million. I think it was $540 million. But they didn't pay a single dollar or ruble. They paid nothing. Zero. This is absolutely unacceptable. Naturally, Gazprom withdrew all those discounts according to the existing agreement. The short-term implications of this are that Russia cannot unilaterally bear such a burden. This is the reason why we turn to our European partners and friends in the hope to hold a meeting as soon as possible and to find ways of providing assistance and support to Ukraine's economy. Those who truly care for Ukraine and the Ukrainian people should make their contribution into the effort to prevent the Ukrainian economy from going bankrupt. Pastries on Maidan are not enough to stop the Ukrainian economy from total chaos. Our US partners, who responded so negatively to our proposal, which was very strange, announced that they were ready to provide only $1 billion. And even that comes not in the form of loans or aid, but in the form of guarantees. What are those guarantees? Those guarantees for the banks that are willing to finance Ukraine. But there are no such banks. This means there is no aid. This is really a very strange situation, and it causes us legitimate concern.
As we reported yesterday, the U.S. government is refusing to allow Iran's newly appointed ambassador to the United Nations entry into the country to assume his post in New York City. The same U.S. Senate that has been deadlocked on a number of matters of great concern to the U.S. public, such as the economy, Social Security, Medicare, and food stamps, was able to muster a vote of 100-0 Thursday on a resolution calling for the ban. Dr. James E. Jennings is the executive director of U.S. Academics for Peace. He was previously a professor of Middle East history at a number of colleges and universities, including the University of Illinois, University of Tennessee, and Wheaton College. Earlier this year, he led a group of academics and students on a trip to Iran. He spoke with Radio VR's Kels Hetherington about the unusual ban of an accredited diplomat.
Tell me about this trip to Iran. Well, it's the second major trip we had there with a series of U.S. university professors from different universities. This time we had 10 universities represented. Some of them were theological schools. Because of the nature of the Iranian regime, we thought that would be a good idea. But we have political scientists from Rutgers University, the State University of New Jersey, for example, and others throughout the nation.
And why did you want to go to Iran?
Well, we have been concerned for some time about the beating of the war drums in Washington from certain sectors of the American political spectrum. And it's basically the same people who brought you the Iraq War. If you think that was a good idea, then you should support them. But I just remind you that Senator John McCain, one of the advocates early on of the Iraq War, recently stated, and I heard him say this on television, that Iraq was an abject failure. And he repeated it twice, an abject failure. That should give us pause about the course that this coalition of neocons and Zionists are undertaking in Iran.
So, James, are you suggesting that Iran may be the beginnings of a new Iraq war?
It's very difficult to see how, at this point in time, we can escape that conclusion because of recent activity at the U.S. Senate and the blocking of the visa for the Iranian ambassador to the UN, the new one that's been appointed by President Rouhani's government, who is a relative moderate who has been elected in Iran.
Well, I want to talk to you about this proposed choice for UN ambassador that Iran has made. Iran has requested a visa for a man it wants to make its UN ambassador. The UN, of course, is in New York City. So they need a U.S. visa for the man. And he was part of the group that attacked the embassy back in 1979, the U.S. embassy in Tehran. Now, it seems appropriate that we would not allow someone like this to enter the United States. Would you disagree with that logic?
That makes a certain amount of sense if you don't know the real situation.
Okay.
The real situation is that in Iran, the new moderate government that has been elected is very concerned. They're looking over their shoulders at their hardliners, just as we in the U.S. Congress are looking over our shoulders at the hardliners. And in order to keep those people on board, which are necessary for the Iranian parliament to ratify any agreement, perhaps this is why they put this man's name in for UN ambassador. Now, I met with the previous UN ambassador, Mr. Kazai, and he is very favorable to a diplomatic settlement for this crisis or this conflict. And I do believe that Mr. Abu Talibi, who's the name of the new person who's been put forward, is also a very progressive person.
But he is the same person who was part of this mob that attacked the U.S. embassy in Iran in 1979. Do you think this person should enter the U.S.?
Our laws say that a person cannot be convicted unless convicted in a court of law, so that there's facts brought forward. This gentleman, Mr. Abu Talibi, says that he was a member of the group that took over the embassy. He had nothing to do with it, because there were many people in Iran who were members at that time. They asked him to come and be a translator between the captives and the thugs, basically, who were holding those captives, and he consented to do so. He said he had nothing to do with the actual takeover or the occupation. He was there at the time. And we have to perhaps believe him on that, because nobody can go back and prove it. The other thing is that the spirit of the United Nations Charter is being violated by denying somebody a visa if a country accredits him and sends him here just because it happens to be in New York.
Yeah, Yahoo is reporting that in 1947 there was this agreement that requires the United States to approve visa applications for those selected by their respective countries to come to the United States in order to be the country's United Nations representative.
That is right. That's correct.
Now, the Iranians want a lot from the United States right now. They're negotiating for some trade with us and the world community. why don't we just tell them to pick someone else to send to the UN, and that this one is not good enough for us?
That's a good point, and I think that has effectively been done. They may comply with that, and yet it seems to me it's a violation of the spirit of the UN Charter to say, well, we're going to pick your emissaries for you. I think that one of the things that will lead us to war is the fact that the United States has been used to dictating its will around the world since World War II. And secondly, the people in Iran have been used to being stepped on for 100 or 150 years, and their pride is involved, so they will react against this. Right now, there are 150 members of the Iranian parliament who are just as hard-nosed as our right-wingers are in our Congress in this country. As I said, I can only guess, but it seems to me that it may be a sop that President Rouhani is throwing to the right-wingers in his Congress. He does, in his parliament, he does have many of those very conservative people who would just as soon fight as switch. So that's very dangerous on both sides if we have hardliners running the show, as Senator Ted Cruz, for example. We will not get anywhere with any negotiations. Believe me, the people we met with, and we met with the chief nuclear leader for the nuclear negotiations team for 3 hours, and they really want to do this deal. And I think President Obama does, and Secretary Kerry does, but there are some people, such as Senator Menendez, who would just as soon not. And certainly,
but they don't show they want to cooperate when they do things like suggest someone who is involved in the hostage taking at the U.S. Embassy in 1979 ought to be the new U.N. ambassador. I mean, this is just, let's say that Nazi Germany had wanted to send Adolf Hitler. And I know this is absurd, but let's use an absurd case. Would you have said, okay, well, if they have that right, let them send Adolf Hitler to be their representative at the United Nations? Would that be acceptable to you?
No, a person convicted of war crimes should not enter the United States. But just to make another supposition, suppose the United Nations were moved to Geneva, and we had nothing to say about whether Iran could appoint that representative or not. The spirit of the UN is let them appoint whoever they want. We may despise their regime, but we must accept whoever they send to talk with us if you'd rather talk than fight. And so this is a conundrum. I'm very sorry that it has happened, because I think it has delayed or blocked developments. But I do believe the Iranians are sincerely desirous of having this problem settled and get it behind them.
Africa is the richest continent on planet Earth, but due to centuries of colonial exploitation by Europe and the U.S., its people today are among the poorest in human history. Despite this fact, Africa appears to be losing rather than gaining jobs. Derek Mbata reports.
Despite its economic growth, Africa is not using its commodities to create jobs, according to a senior United Nations official. Carlos Lopez, the executive secretary of the UN Economic Commission for Africa, spoke at the launch of the 2014 Economic Report on Africa, which is focusing on industrialization. He said efforts to embark on industrialization on the continent faced problems in the 1970s for various reasons, including too much state intervention and the oil crisis of 1972. Mr. Lopez said Africa is regressing in its manufacturing sector because it continues to export commodities instead of processing them and adding value before they are exported.
Africa has a controlling stake on a number of commodities, so we have the opportunity of better negotiate those commodities. We know that mispricing is depriving Africa of about $50 billion a year, and mispricing is just one element of the bad equation. Another one is the lack of value addition on our commodities. And all of those resources basically are, in very concrete terms, signifying that Africa is exporting its jobs instead of creating them. Because the value addition is taking place somewhere else, we are exporting the jobs.
Mr. Lopez said Africa needs what he called an organic proposal for industrialization that is truly embedded in the realities of the continent, and not a pure imitation of what other regions have done. He also noted that as a latecomer in industrialization, Africa is confronted with the worst global environment where there is no level playing field. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
Information remains scarce on the woman that authorities said threw a shoe at Hillary Clinton Thursday as she gave a speech at a convention in Nevada.
What was that, a bat? Was that a bat? Is that somebody throwing something at me? Is that part of Cirque du Soleil?
The Las Vegas Bureau of the Secret Service said the woman was arrested and charged with disorderly conduct. They still haven't released any information about her motive for throwing the shoe, although they said she was detained and interviewed for several hours. They did say the woman is from Arizona and had traveled to Las Vegas. Clinton was speaking at a recycling convention when the incident occurred. The Secret Service said the shoe thrower was not a registered attendee of the convention, but a guest of the hotel that hosted it. After months of protests by the U.S.-backed opposition in Venezuela, the two sides sat down at a meeting sponsored by UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations. We discussed this and other news from the region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, in Managua. So, Tony Solo, how are you today?
Yeah, things are going fine here. I got up really early this morning to water some of the plants at the back of the school because the weather's very, very hot here. And it's the hottest time of the year around Semana Santa. Semana Santa's next week, as you know.
Let's talk about some of the things that have happened there. I guess first the election.
Yeah, there was the election in Costa Rica. Very, very strange election, Don, because about a month prior to it was last Sunday in Costa Rica, it was the second round of the presidential election. Right. And there were two main candidates, Luis Guillermo Solis and a guy called Johnny Araya. And you may remember must be about 4 or 5, maybe even 6 weeks ago when we were discussing it. I didn't have a good handle on the election, partly because it was quite confusing. Mm. And the first round had an awful lot of parties in it. But there was one thing that was very clear, and that was that the Laura Chinchilla's party, Laura Chinchilla is now she's the outgoing president in Costa Rica. And she was a stalwart member of the Arias-dominated party, the ruling party that has pretty much held power in Costa Rica for the last 15, 20 years, something like that.
Right.
And it's very much controlled by Oscar Arias and his brother and their cronies, of whom Laura Chinchilla is one. And she had a disastrous record in government. And so one thing that was very clear when we were talking about this electoral process in Costa Rica 5 or 6 weeks ago was that the governing party candidate, this guy Johnny Araya, might do well or reasonably well on the first round, but he would definitely lose on the second round. And I didn't think it would come out quite so starkly, but after the first round, the two leading candidates were in fact Luis Guillermo Solis of the Partido Acción Ciudadana, Citizens Action Party, and this guy Johnny Araya of the governing party, and it was everybody was pretty sure that Solis would win, and then as in the first weeks of the post first round campaigning, Johnny Araya's poll numbers were absolutely catastrophic. I mean, he was something like over 40% behind in the opinion polls.
I know, it was amazing.
And he just made an announcement, presumably to save, not to waste campaign funding. Right. He made an announcement that he wouldn't campaign.
Right, he was dropping out, basically.
he just threw in the towel, and kind of almost a month. Yep. Before the final second round ballot.
Yep.
And so when the election on last Sunday finally happened, Luis Guillermo Solis won with something like 70% of the votes. And there was a very high level of abstention, I think very high by Costa Rican standards. I mean, it was around 40%, perhaps even a little more than 40%, which for Costa Rica is a very high level of abstention.
Mm.
And not common at all. And so now we have this guy elected, Luis Guillermo Solis, and there's a lot of positive vibes around his election because he's promised to represent a dramatic break from the kind of corrupt machine-style politics of the Arias clan and the political class that has dominated Costa Rica for the last 20, 25 years. But I know they all say that, don't they? You know, yeah. And we'll see what happens.
Yeah, but he at least is identified as not of the right. He's like a soft left candidate in a country that has had for the last 15 or 20 years a right-wing government.
Yeah, and they're center-right. I mean, the Arias brothers kind of define themselves as social democrat, but in Central American terms, especially in terms of foreign policy, social democrat here is equivalent to kind of center-right.
Yeah, well, like in Britain. So, the same as like UK.
Yeah. So, yeah, and in fact, of course, here in Central America, one of the selling points in years gone by of the social democrat message was, oh, we're so like those successful Europeans, vote for us. And of course, that's come back to haunt them.
Now. Yeah, right.
Because Europe's in the toilet economically, politically, socially, in all so many ways.
Oh, yeah. We're getting tight on time. One last thing I'd like to touch on is the meeting between Maduro in Venezuela and the opposition, including Capriles, and being sponsored by UNASUR.
Yeah, and that's a very, very important development. And I don't know, and Capriles was more, and it seems to me that Capriles was more or less bound to participate in that if he was to maintain any credibility as the leader of some kind of democratic opposition.
Right.
Because it's one, I don't know if I'm right about this, but it seems to me that President Maduro and his colleagues have managed to force the opposition putschists, really. I mean, what they've been trying to carry out the same kind of putsch that the United States and its allies were able to force through in the Ukraine.
Right.
And I think the parallel is very fair.
Oh, for sure.
And the putschists have been forced by the U.S. government, by the Venezuelan government's policy, to either recognize the government and participate in the dialogue, or be completely marginalized as a violent radical extremist.
And by the whole region, by the way.
That's going to pan out well for the Venezuelan government.
Agreed. By the whole region, by the way. I mean, there's the OAS vote that was held to attempting to condemn the Venezuelan government, and the only ones in the region that voted with it was Panama, the United States, and Mexico, right?
Right, I'm surprised that Costa Rica didn't, but that's a good example of the way United States policy, we've been talking about this for years now, and the United States policy in the region is completely counterproductive in terms of the best interests of the U.S. people.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the context under which that arm twisting took place at the OAS, domestically, it was the same time that they were seeing the polling go for the candidate of, you know, for Arias, you know, was polling in the toilet. And so to take an affirmative act. And there's a contradiction that the right has to face in this emerging condition in Central South America, Caribbean region, which is that one of the primary focuses of the integration is to retain the sovereignty of those countries vis-a-vis the United States, which has historically impeded that. And the basis of the right wing generally politically is sort of a trumped up version of nationalism. And the contradiction between the rhetoric of nationalism and the acquiescence to a foreign power really undermines the credibility of those right wing governments. So they have to go along.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's very true, Don. And and of course, when that contradiction is combined with the complete failure of U.S. allies in the region to offer any kind of viable economic and social policy that people could have any confidence in, and the result is the right-wing allies in countries like Nicaragua, for example, don't even the whole right wing polls something like 8% national support. So and that is a direct result of failed U.S. government foreign policy.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.